Coming up now is the Space Show.
We have six wheels ready to roll, exploring craters and across plateaus. Sand, rock, ice and snow, we lay code. We have camera eyes, scan the land, retractable arm with a scooping hand, a drill to see what's below, solar panels to make us go. We're the Mars rovers just saying hello. Our bodies run experiments. We're full of technology designed in our set. We send our results to mission control. Fire the laser! Make another hole. We're the Mars rovers. We're just saying hello. Rover, shout out! Sojourner! Spirit! Opportunity! Curiosity and perseverance. We're the detectives of Mars past, discovering clues for science facts. We even take selfies to share with you. Maybe someday you'll be on Mars too. We're the Mars rovers, we're just saying hello.
Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, the Curiosity rover has been exploring Gale Crater on Mars for 10 years. We remember back to its landing day and find what it has been doing since. And to start the show, we had the Rover Romp by Stacey Fox, who mentioned in that song from 2020 about the rovers that have been sent to Mars.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon, and you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
On Monday, 2012, August 6, several hundred people gathered at the Victorian Space Science Education Centre in Strathmore. Like Charlie Duke, they were about to turn blue. On that afternoon, a spacecraft called Curiosity was approaching Mars. Soon, at 3:18 p.m., it would attempt a landing in Gale Crater using a revolutionary technique called Skycrane. A technique so complex that many, myself included, feared that it would most likely fail. With bated breath, we watched a video link from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory as the rover descended. And yes, we were all turning blue. Amazingly, the touchdown was successful.
Hi, do you want to give us a reaction to what's happened?
Oh, that is absolutely fantastic. And JPL have sent lots of robots out there before, but this one is absolutely incredible. And it's so excited, you could feel it in the room. It's sensational.
And were you expecting success or failure?
No, I was a little bit concerned because it was a little bit trickier than the bouncing balls that they've used before. But, fortunately for everybody. And it's great to see Charles Bolden come out and really support all those guys that were in that room. Fantastic.
All right, do you have a reaction?
Oh, I just was amazed and so happy that it all worked out really well. So congratulations to everybody concerned. That was fantastic.
Hello, Peter. Do you have a reaction?
I'm ecstatic. It was brilliant. Very, very good.
What was your expectation beforehand?
Well, I thought it was going to about a 70% chance of landing. I thought we had about a 50-50 chance of actually knowing when we would find out if it was going to be successful. So the fact that they got it down, we knew about it, and then to get a couple of images to confirm the fact, absolutely stunning. Really brilliant.
Late that Monday afternoon, when the celebrations subsided, we left Strathmore happy that we had seen the start of a new era in Martian exploration. A Curiosity was not the first craft to land successfully on Mars. In 1971, the Soviet Union's Mars 3 was the first, but failed 110 seconds after landing, having transmitted only a grey image with no details. The Mars 3 lander carried a small 4.5-kilogram rover called Prop M. Now, we'll have to wait until a human mission, or perhaps an advanced future rover, to know whether the Prop M ever deployed. The next rover on Mars was Sojourner in 1997, 25 years and 1 month ago. Now, Marian Anderson was, and still is, a lecturer at Monash University in Clayton. She was at the Strathmore event in 2012, and she spoke about Sojourner.
This little beast down here, this is Sojourner, the Sojourner rover. This landed on Mars in 1997 and ran for around about 80 days before it finally lost contact with Earth. It wasn't actually able to send information back to Earth on its own. It had a base station. It would transmit information from this little antenna here to the base station, and the base station would send that information back to Earth. We lost contact with the base station after about 80 days, and Sojourner, the rover, was programmed so that if it didn't get a command from Earth through the base station, it was supposed to return to the base station and then just circle it until it was told what to do. It may still be doing that. The poor little darling.
To mark the 20th anniversary of Sojourner, United Kingdom poet Stuart Atkinson wrote this, simply titled Sojourner. Before Curiosity landed in the shadow of alias Mons, lowered to the ground by the "Are you insane?" sky crane, before Opportunity rolled across Miradani to drop into Eagle Crater in that cosmic hole-in-one, before Spirit bounced and boinged across Gustav's dusty floor, scaring us all half to death before finally phoning home, there was Sojourner. Ah, Sojourner. Some of us knew you before that spud-munching castaway dug you up, in totally the wrong place, then brought you back to life like young Frankenstein. You were the queen of the first internet age, when America Online was emperor of cyberspace, and living rooms and dens all around the world forced to the chirps and cheeps of the dial-up connections. And stop buffering screams. No high-definition live streaming in those days. No flat earth YouTube channels to subscribe to. No data-flogging Facebook full of photographs of cats and look what I had for breakfast. No basement-dwelling Twitter trolls, fat-shaming film stars, or 4 a.m. Trump rants threatening nuclear war. Most heard you'd landed the old-fashioned way, on the news, and only a few of us could get online to see the images you returned. Back then, having the internet was like owning a TV after World War II. I was still years away from my first toe dip into the pixelated sea. A kind friend of mine printed off your images for me and pushed them through my door. And those pictures, so much more perfect than they had a right to be with that Times tech. I remember gasping at the sight of snub-nosed Yogi, encrusted with dust, Barnacle Bill, pitted and pocked, Scooby-Doo and Bam Bam, also close enough to touch. And you, looking like an unwanted toy discarded in a quarry floor, dwarfed by Half Dome and Shark and all the other tombstone boulders, swept down Arisvallis by ancient angry floods. But you didn't care. You just rolled around them, or clambered over them if you could, as curious and carefree as a cat, your spiky little wheels pointing this way and that. Your descendants will stay on Mars forever. Too big to send home, but I hope they find a way to bring you back to Earth one day. Then everyone will see that you were so much more than Matt Damon's robot dog. and that was by Stuart Atkinson. Now, 5 months after Curiosity's landing, Stuart Atkinson bewailed the dwindling public interest in the Opportunity rover that had, by that time, been trundling across Mirradani Plenum for 9 years. By early 2013, Opportunity was scouting an area where the features were named after Australian landmarks. In 2013, he wrote, At Nine. A few faithful friends have stayed by my side. Their reassuring hands laid loyally on my back. But most have forgotten me, abandoned me, to fawn over another considered more beautiful than I. Younger, taller, with eyes that shoot invisible fire, and a miniature sun for a heart. They follow her now, woo her now, walk beside her as she slinks, snail-paced, over the dry, round, pebbled riverbeds of gale, delighting them with her outlandish tales of gently lapping waters and softly falling rain, laughing too loudly at anything she says. They've left me to stand alone, here, on my lonely island of stone. If I was bitter or jealous, which of course a mer robot cannot be, I might feel the need to remind you all I was doing a science before she was even born, before her army of curious geeks began gleefully retweeting the term. For soul after soul I have roved this world, crossed its deserts, driven to, round and into its dust bowl craters for almost 10 Terran years. So this planet holds no fears for me now, after so many days of being stalked by sudden death. But no matter, I'm a Martian now. This is my home. This is where I live, where I wake and sleep, where I creep on creaking wheels around the time-warm rim of great endeavour. Soul after soul after soul. Each sunrise, a delightful, I'm still alive, surprise. Each glacial lavender sunset met with a whispered, please let me wake again. There's so much more for me to do here yet, prayer. I'm a Martian now. Earth is just a memory, a ghostly wraith. It calls out to me as I stand bathed in the dusty half-light of every dusk and dawn. A sapphire spark embedded in the grey, my very own Kathy, moaning, how could you leave me? As I look down from Cape York's slowly weathering heights, watching dust devils waltzing far below, following barely there Mara's tails of cloud drifting through the honey-hued sky, feeling the breeze rolling over, around and through me. I shiver as her phantom breath, blowing across that timeless gulf of space, chills my face, stinging my eyes as I gaze lovingly at Mars. These are my brooding Bronte moors, my fields of gold, covered not with softly swaying grass, but billions of broken stones. No whimmed whipped trees here. The ancient breeze carries only the sound of boulders being ground to sand. 1 millimetre every million years. And yet, I grow weary of this place. I itch to race away from these stegosaur spine blades of stone and roam onwards, onwards, south to where Tribulation's lofty peak calls out like a mermaid beckoning me. Up there is where I should be, looking down on where I am now, where I have been for so long, snuffling about for traces of clays around these pale and hasty plates. I am a Martian now. Brother to Bradbury's sand ships, sister to Kim Stanley Robinson's stone-clad essay-snuggling rovers, kin to HG's Ulla, singing tripods. I am a Barsoomian sculpture, Its dust coats and covers every part of me, has penetrated deep down into the very heart of me. There is not a nut or bolt of me free from the touch of this planet's powdered rust. I am a Martian now. We're now on the space show, back to Marian Anderson. As I said, she's a lecturer at Monash University, and she was a member of the Landing Site Selection Committee for Curiosity. Less than an hour before Curiosity landed in Gale Crater, she told us at Strathmore why that site had been chosen.
Why is it going where it's going? Well, initially there were over 128 landing sites suggested. We started work on landing sites for this back in 2003. And the brief was we could land anywhere within about 60 degrees of the equator. Then they looked at the engineering difficulties a bit more and said, well, actually, no, go within about 30 degrees of the equator. And the idea was to find a site which might preserve organic materials. If life ever arose on Mars and has been fossilised, those organic molecules might be preserved in the rocks. So we needed to find a place that was absolutely ideal. And after almost 9 years of deliberation, Gale Crater, just here, was selected. Now, Gale Crater is just on the boundary between bits here, which are the northern plains of Mars, which are very, very flat, and they're flat because these are the ancient ocean of Mars. Under the surface here, about 15 centimetres of dust, under 15 centimetres of dust, it is solid water ice. We now know that based on the Phoenix rover data and also on a number of craters that have been formed in these plains over the past few years. So Gale Crater here is just on the boundary between that northern ocean, which is frozen, and the southern higher areas. Generally, when craters form, you get a small rebound peak in the middle. The crust bounces back up. Gale Crater has a whopping great mountain in the middle of it. And the only way that mountain could form is if, when this crater formed, the crust below it cracked, and hot water came up out of the Martian subsurface and stuck all of the sediments that have later filled the crater together. That water has then allowed the rest of the dust to be blown away over time, and what's left are the sediments that were produced by this hot spring. So this is the mountain in the centre. This is called Mount Sharp after an American geologist, but Gale Crater is actually named after an Australian, Walter Gale, who was very active in the astronomy area in Sydney. He was an amateur astronomer, spent most of his time as a bank manager, but we won't hold that against him. So, yeah, this is Gale Crater here. It's quite large. To give an idea of how large, a top-down view, that is Port Phillip over the top of Mount Sharp in the middle of Gale Crater. So we're not talking about a small bit here. Initially, the landing site we picked in Gale Crater, we needed an area that was at least 20 kilometres by 20 kilometres, which was flat enough, had no boulders bigger than about half a metre in size, and which we could drop a rover on top of. In terms of the height of Mount Sharp, if you're standing on the plains down here, looking up at the top, this is a 5 kilometre high mountain. To give you an idea of how high that is, if you're standing at the base of Mount Everest in the Himalayas, you've only got another 2.5 kilometres of mountain above you. So from the base down here to the top, this is higher, twice as high from your viewpoint as Mount Everest is. So this is a pretty high mountain. If we look at the side of Mount Sharp, going from the base where the rover is going to land, up the side of it through here, we can see there's different types of rocks. The green star down here represents clay layers. Now, clays form in water, and clays are really, really good for preserving organic chemicals. If anything ever lived on Mars in the water that was bubbling up through these rocks or in the Northern Ocean that spilled into this crater, they will be preserved in these rocks. Above that, we've got sulfates, which are part of the hot spring minerals that have come out. They are also very, very good for preserving organic chemicals. And then we've got a fractured area up through here. It may take 6 months to get from where it lands to the base of Mount Sharp, but it'll be doing good geology the whole way along. It'll be sniffing at every bit of rock it passes, testing the soil, tasting it, seeing what it's made of, and sending back data every day. And that data will go live on the website, so you'll be able to go to its website and monitor its day-by-day action. Once it gets up into the foothills of Mount Sharp, it'll be going over a series of ridges, and the views are going to be pretty spectacular. Every other landing site on Mars has been flat. It's kind of looked like the outback a bit north of Coober Pedy, minus the bushes. This is going to be rocky, hilly, and hopefully is going to be good enough to make the front pages of most newspapers. As I mentioned before, it's equipped with a laser, so yes, we are sending a ray gun to Mars. Hopefully the Martians won't object too much. But this allows the rover to target and sample rocks that it physically can't reach, which is particularly good for us. And if it finds anything really interesting, it'll put its arm against it, take samples out of it, and then drop them into an analysis bay up in the centre of the rover, and then tell us what they're made of.
From Monash University in Clayton, that was Marianne Anderson, and she was speaking at the Victorian Space Science Education Centre in Strathmore less than an hour before the Curiosity landing.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
Oh, I was a cynic. I didn't think it would work, but it did work, and I'm looking forward to some very interesting images over the next couple of years.
Were you surprised that they got images back right away?
No, I knew they were going to get images back immediately, but what I was more concerned about was the landing sequence, because it was just so risky, but it all worked. I'll be the first person to eat my words and say that NASA did an outstanding job.
Any reactions to the landing?
Oh, it's marvellous it landed. Absolutely marvellous. I really was afraid it wasn't going to land because it was one of the most technical things that we'd ever done, but it's really good and we're really happy that it's landed, because if we'd have had our Mars landing party here and it hadn't, if we'd have all been sad. Now we're all happy, which is good.
Yes, a bit like the scenes in JPL. Where are we now?
We're at the Victorian Space Science Education Centre, a purpose-built Special Space Science Centre, one of the six that the Victorian State Government have, and we're here at Strathmore Secondary College.
Now, 10 years since the landing. So, to celebrate that 10 years, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory has prepared this feature about Curiosity's 10 years on Mars.
At first glance, the Mars rover Curiosity, a six-wheeled vehicle that weighs nearly a ton, looks like a mashup between a dune buggy and a space-age robot. But in many ways, Curiosity has been made in our image, with camera eyes that gaze out from a head supported by a neck and an arm and hand that can scoop things up and dig into rocks and dirt. The rover also has a kind of mouth, nose, throat, and stomach. These allow Curiosity to take Mars into itself, breathing in the air and eating the rocks and soil, becoming one with the desert landscape. Over the years, Curiosity has chewed on the question of what the planet Mars is made of, conducting an elementary study of the alien environment. For instance, after Curiosity crunches on some rock, pulverizing it down to the size of half a baby aspirin tablet, the sample travels through vibrating tubes that connect the rover's mouth to its stomach, an instrument the size of a microwave oven, called Sample Analysis at Mars, or SAM. For us, stomach acids break down our food to fuel our bodies. But for Curiosity, heating the rock powder to extremely high temperatures vaporizes compounds into gases that the SAM instrument can identify. This digestion takes so much energy, the rover can do little else during the process, a robot version of a food coma. The vibrating tubes that allow Curiosity to swallow a sample normally sound like this. This makes Curiosity's throat more than just a passageway, because operators can direct the rover to alter those vibrations, teaching Curiosity to sing. On August 5, 2013, when Curiosity had been on Mars for one Earth year, the mission team held a birthday party. Even though Curiosity was millions of miles away and couldn't blow out the candle on its cake, the rover was able to sing the birthday song, harmonizing with the gusting wind to create the first melody ever to ring out on Mars.
Start. 2, 1. Booster ignition.
We are receiving RP drones at this time.
0.7 meters a second.
We've acquired the ground with the radar. We are wheels down on Mars.
Oh my God.
This is amazing.
Welcome to On a Mission, a podcast of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I'm Leslie Mullen, and in this fourth season of the podcast, we're following in the tracks of rovers on Mars. A ton of curiosity. The Curiosity rover was already in the planning stages when the twin Spirit and Opportunity rovers launched to Mars in 2003. When Spirit and Opportunity began exploring opposite sides of the planet, Curiosity's design was advanced by their experiences, as well as that of Little Sojourner, the first rover NASA landed on Mars in 1997 as part of the Pathfinder mission. Sojourner had been a test to see if we could operate a vehicle on Mars. Spirit and Opportunity were built on Sojourner's success and ran with it, traveling far and wide and using various instruments along the way to reveal a picture of Mars from the ancient past, when water once shimmered on what is now a bone-dry world. Curiosity was to be the next evolution in Mars rovers.
I'm Ashwin Vasavada, and I'm the project scientist for the Curiosity rover, also more formally known as the Mars Science Laboratory mission. I think a lot of people, even kids these days, have an understanding of what a Mars rover is, but they may not appreciate the size. It's a car-sized rover. This isn't like Sojourner, the thing you could kind of hold in your hands, or Spirit and Opportunity, the next JPL rovers, which are usually compared to golf cart size. Curiosity is kind of a beast. It's big. It's lumbering. It weighs a ton. You could barely fit it in your garage. It has kind of really wide wheels like a Hummer, but then a short, small body like a Mini Cooper. And it contains a ton of great scientific instruments.
Instruments can only be miniaturized so much, and Curiosity has 10 to carry, as well as a hefty arm that holds a large drill. Before the mission was named the Mars Science Laboratory, before a 12-year-old girl from Kansas named Clara Ma won a student contest to name the rover Curiosity, it was known as the Mega Rover. The rover had to be big to accommodate all the tools needed to carry out its mission on Mars.
The overall goal is to figure out if Mars ever had the conditions that could have supported life. How we accomplish that is to be a virtual field geologist. And field geologists are geologists who go out into places where you could study the rocks and kind of read the history of those rocks and figure out what the environments were like when those rocks were first formed, and then after they were formed, how they changed. There's no yardstick for habitability. You can't go out and measure it with a single experiment. You have to put together a bunch of different information that has to do with the availability of water and the nature of that water. You know, water isn't necessarily great for life. It's a prerequisite, but it also could be too salty or it could be too acidic. So you have to measure that water in detail. And the water is no longer there. So really, you're inferring the water through things like chemistry and mineralogy and the rocks themselves. You know, do the rocks appear like they're made of sediment that was once deposited in a river or a stream? And so that's what we do on Mars. We have cameras where we can survey the landscape. We have spectrometers that tell us the chemistry of the rocks and soils. And then the thing that really is the cornerstone of the payload and what makes the rover so big is that we drill into rocks and we scoop soil and we deliver that rock or soil to laboratories that are actually built inside the rover. And those laboratories really tell us the details of what chemicals and minerals are in those rocks and soils.
Curiosity's drill is the first ever to be used on Mars. The rover also has a laser in its head that can zap rocks up to 23 feet or 7 meters away, vaporizing fragments and analyzing the gases that result to figure out what a rock is made of. Such an imposing rover uses a lot of energy, more than could be reliably provided by solar panels like those on Sojourner, Spirit, and Opportunity. So Curiosity is nuclear powered, with a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, or RTG, slanted up from its backside like a bird's tail. 10 pounds of plutonium-238 dioxide puts off heat as it naturally decays, keeping the rover warm while also charging its batteries. JPL engineer Matt Wallace had worked on NASA's first three Mars rovers, but still found building Curiosity to be an overwhelming experience.
So on Curiosity, I was the flight system manager. Sometimes I just call it the spacecraft manager. And holding on for dear life. I mean, it was very, very hard development. Everything was new. I think going in, we felt like we would more easily be able to scale Spirit and Opportunity up than, in fact, we were. I mean, Curiosity is an order of magnitude bigger than Spirit and Opportunity, and it was really a fundamentally different rover. Almost everything started from scratch, and probably the biggest challenges were the mechanisms. So, for instance, there were drive motors, there were steering motors and gearboxes. The high-gain antenna, which has to point to the Earth, that's a mechanism. The big robot arm, which has 5 degrees of freedom, we call it, basically pivot points. That's a mechanism. The drill that collects the samples, that's a mechanism. And all of these require specialized elements that can tolerate the temperature extremes with unique seals to keep the dust out. That's the downside to rovers. They're great. They give you mobility, but they have a lot of mechanisms.
The challenge of building all of the rover's complex mechanisms proved to be even harder than expected. Although the Mars Science Laboratory mission had been scheduled to fly in 2009, by the end of 2008, NASA held a press conference to announce more time was needed.
We're going to rephase MSL for a 2011 launch. This will allow for careful resolution of any remaining technical problems, proper and thorough testing, and avoid a mad dash to launch. Failure is not an option on this mission. The science is too important, and the investment...
Because of how the planets align as they orbit the sun, the best time to fly a spacecraft from Earth to Mars is every 26 months. The mission team used that more than two-year launch delay to resolve problems and do more testing of different elements, including the new landing system that was devised to get this much bigger, heavier rover safely to Mars. Airbags had cushioned the landings of the previous Mars rovers, and they'd bounced many times on the planet's surface before rolling to a stop. Airbags able to cushion Curiosity's landing would be so big and heavy, they'd be too cumbersome to pack onto a spacecraft. Here's Brian Muirhead, chief engineer of the mission when it was in the planning stages.
And that was when we invented the sky crane. There was a handful of us that met and worked through all our options for landing this big rover, which was very different than either Sojourner or Spirit and Opportunity. And we arrived at the sky crane as the absolute best approach. And then it was part of my job in 2003 to go sell that. And that was hard because it sounded crazy. And in some ways it was. But on the other hand, it was really very well-reasoned engineering.
The sky crane is just one element of Curiosity's landing. The friction of entering the atmosphere is the first way the spacecraft slows down from its fast flight to Mars. A parachute is released to further slow the speed of descent. But a parachute can only slow you down so much in the thin Martian air. As the rover gets closer to the surface, the parachute is let go, and a jetpack, a backpack of retro rockets, fires toward the ground. When it reaches 60 feet, or 18 meters above the surface, the jetpack hovers, and the sky crane kicks in. The rover is lowered by 3 nylon ropes until its wheels touch Martian soil. At that point, the ropes are cut free, and the jetpack flies off, eventually crash landing a safe distance away.
It was the right answer, and we just had to prove it to people. But the thing about it is we didn't know for sure, because we could never test entry, descent, and landing on Mars, anywhere but at Mars.
All the elements of the entry, descent, and landing system had been tested over and over again on Earth. By testing it from start to finish at high altitude, where the air is thinner and better mimics the Martian atmosphere, would have been too dangerous and costly. The only way to know for sure if the landing system would work was to send it to Mars.
3, 2, 1. Main engine start, 0, and liftoff of the Atlas V with Curiosity, seeking clues to the planetary puzzle about life on Mars.
Curiosity left Earth on November 26, 2011, starting a nearly 9-month journey that would take it to Gale Crater, an impact crater just south of the Mars equator that's 96 miles or 154 kilometers across, the same length as the state of Delaware.
And we'll have more from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory coming up in the space show in a few minutes. But first, Christo Warner is an Australian who in 2010 believed that Mars is my neighbour. Let's hear from him.
Poetry with hands and stuff. This one's called Mars is my neighbour. Mars is my neighbour. Danger money, resistance to the edge. So I open on what seems to be a blank page. Always a timeless history awaiting eternity. From here to there to over there, a telescope mind. Don't hold me too tight or let me go too far. Over the fence, she calls, over the river. Sail on time. Frame my journey, our art. Raise your sign, define, sublime. Spatial. There is a mole peeking through the black hole. Stories from this side and that, they perforate the fences. Mars is my neighbour and barriers release to peace. The friction and face of an entity juxtaposed. What you do is your business, but we are your stakeholders. The river branches, excitement builds, decision pending. Speechwriters wrangle for position. Marketers may bet. Journalists jar. Cameras flash. Ch-ch-ch. Headlines dash. The people they play. And Mars is my neighbour.
Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Yes, the space show is pleased to announce a new 54-part series called Lunar Science. This is not about spaceships and astronauts. It is about the science to be done on and near the Moon during the Artemis project and the supporting unmanned missions. To find these programs, visit space.southernfm.com.au. Then scroll down until you see the Lunar Science link. Once again, Lunar Science is available online at space.southernfm.com.au.
Southern FM.
On air and online via the free Community Radio Plus app. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play.
And now on the space show, we return to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where they are celebrating 10 years since the landing of Curiosity on Mars.
Ashwin had worked on the mission for 8 years before it finally launched, and part of his preparation included visiting places on Earth that resemble Gale Crater.
We see a lot of similar features to the Southwest United States in the rocks on Mars. So we went to places in New Mexico. We went to the Mojave Desert. We went to Death Valley, where you can see some wonderful examples of stromatolites, which are possible evidence of biology in creating textures in rocks. If we were ever to find evidence of life on Mars that you could see with your eyes, it might be a stromatolite. It might be textures in rocks, bends in layers of rocks that form because biology was living as the rocks were deposited. And then there's a place near Pyramid Lake, north of LA, where there is a basin there that had a lot of streams and lakes over thousands of years and left a lot of deposits of those streams and lakes behind, which are very analogous to what we study at Gale Crater. We wanted all of our team members to get that first sense of how to look at a rock and begin to understand the story it's telling. You know, I love going on a long hike through the desert and going through all kinds of different terrains and seeing what's around the next bend. I think every landscape is beautiful and has a story, and I love understanding it. That's what makes me drawn to the science of it, is I love understanding how nature and physics and chemistry have conspired together to create what you're seeing.
Ashwin's love of exploration began with NASA's first landers on Mars.
And then in 1975, two Viking spacecraft were launched, each of which was programmed to land a robot on the Martian surface.
I remember having this book when I was probably 8 or 9 years old that had pictures of the surface of Mars taken by Viking lander, which showed the surface of Mars kind of from eye level. And I could just stare at that for hours. I think that was really the moment that made me want to explore other planets from their surfaces, to be able to virtually kind of walk out in the landscape, see what's around the next bend, climb the next mountain, kick over this rock and dig a hole. So I was big into space, but I really wasn't into being an astronaut. I was the space shuttle generation, and that affected all of us in that generation. But I guess I just thought of the moon as something that humans explored, but that the planets were the realm of like robotic space probes.
Using robots to explore the planets of the solar system seemed worlds away from where he grew up.
I grew up in Northern California in a town called Stockton, which is kind of near Sacramento. And not to overly diss my hometown, but there wasn't a whole lot of great guidance. So I had no idea how to get there, honestly. I had some great teachers in high school that helped me get prepared, but largely I came to college without knowing a thing about how to achieve that dream of being a planetary explorer or what schools were good for it or anything like that. So I had 5 different majors when I was at UCLA that started out in aerospace engineering because it had the word space in it. That's about the level of the thinking, you know? And I realized that there is a difference between engineers and scientists culturally and psychologically maybe. So it wasn't too long before I realized I was less interested in working out solutions to technical problems as in understanding nature. And so then I switched over to physics, and then I found earth science, which I totally loved. Then when you replace Earth with another planet, then you get planetary science. In other words, planetary science really is a field where you get to study atmospheres and oceans, geology, physics. You basically apply everything you'd study on Earth, but to other planets. And that was where I wanted to be, you know, the whole time. But it took me until my 4th year in college to find that.
While he was finding his path to planetary science, Ashwin also marched to another beat.
For many years, I played drums or percussion, you know, in a symphony. And then, of course, marching band. You go to UCLA, you got to play in the marching band. I came to UCLA with 2 majors in mind. I was going to either be music or aerospace engineering. But I think that's maybe where where my parents had a little more influence back then. My father is from India. And in that culture, there's certainly a lot of emphasis on science. I'm sure the thought was I should be a doctor. So planetary science was probably a little bit of a stretch. But I can tell you it was more appealing to him than music, you know.
Ashwin's steps toward becoming a planetary explorer started on a downbeat.
I started my career in an era of planetary exploration that was known more for failure than success. This was in the late 90s. I finished at UCLA after finally finding planetary science as a major and got accepted into Caltech for grad school, which was one of the more unexpected things in my life. And literally the day I was driving from Stockton, where I was spending the summer, and coming to Caltech for my first day of grad school, was the day that Mars Observer spacecraft was lost. It was about to reach Mars, and 3 days from orbit insertion, it exploded when fuel was being moved around. And heard that on the radio as I was coming down to LA. And that was what I was intending to work on in grad school. And so I had to pivot, as they say, and quickly became a student of the outer planets. So I worked on the Galileo mission. I worked on the Cassini mission also. And then I took a postdoc position at UCLA to work on a spacecraft called the Mars Polar Lander.
Jeffrey Kay of KCET Los Angeles begins our report on Mars and the space program.
It seemed to have been a nominal no-contact MR pass.
Although NASA engineers have not completely given up hope, more than likely the missions of the Mars Polar Lander and its companion probes have ended in failure. Early this morning,
so this is my first actual job as a planetary scientist, you know, freshly minted PhD, and worked on it for about a year, getting ready to land. And of course, that mission was lost, in addition to its sister mission, the Mars Climate Orbiter, also lost. And so definitely had a real education in the challenges of exploring Mars and landing on Mars with three different missions being lost that I either was going to work on or did work on. And so I had a very sober mindset when Curiosity was being developed. I put about 8 years of my life into Curiosity's development, all the time knowing, you know, that there wasn't guaranteed that it was going to pay off.
Mission control was tense on landing day as Curiosity reached Mars and sped toward the surface. The Skycrane descent stage now faced its ultimate test.
We found a nice flat place. We're coming in ready for Skycrane. Down to 10 meters per second, 40 meters altitude. Skycrane has started. Descending at about 0.75 meters per second as expected. Expecting bridle cut shortly.
Tango Delta, you remain strong.
Tango Delta nominal.
Tango Delta, or touchdown, is the moment the wheels hit Martian soil. After the Skycrane lowered the rover down from its jetpack, Tango Delta nominal was confirmation that Curiosity's wheels were resting on the ground. But there was no celebration yet, because the rover was still in danger. The ropes, or bridles that tied the jetpack to the rover, needed to let go. If not, the rover could be flung into the air with the jetpack as it flew away from the landing site.
RIMU stable. RIMU stable.
RIMU, or Rover Inertial Measurement Unit, tells whether the rover is moving or not. When RIMU stable was announced, that meant the rover wasn't being dragged across Mars. In other words, the jetpack must have released its hold on the rover before it flew off.
UHF is good.
The UHF is a radio signal the rover uses to talk to Earth. A solid UHF signal meant the jetpack had left the rover still standing in its landing spot, because otherwise, the rover's radio signal would have cut out or faded away.
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
After passing all its health checks, the only thing notably damaged by Curiosity's unique landing was one of its two wind sensors, which had gotten hit by flying pebbles kicked up by the retro rockets. With everything else operating well, the mission of one Martian year, or about 669 Martian days, known as SOLS, could start rolling. Here's Abigail Freeman, deputy project scientist on the mission.
Those were really memorable days because we were all kind of figuring it out as we went along and how to operate this very complicated vehicle and where we had landed and what were we actually looking at the rocks at our feet. And so that was a really intense period of discovery from both the science and the engineering side of things. And there were things that happened at that time that were so stressful that you look back now and you kind of laugh about it. For example, the first time we went to scoop sand, we saw something bright in one of our images and we said, "What's that? What's that?" And everyone kind of panicked and we needed to get a closer look and what is it? And we had to dump the sand sample that we had been working on and pull out the microscope to take a look at it. And it was this little piece of plastic, just really tiny, like a little piece of tape. It must have come off from somewhere. It wasn't Martian, but who knows where. And it was so disruptive and everyone was so stressed out about it. Was it coming from the rover? Was something falling apart?
The rogue bit of plastic that came off Curiosity didn't seem to have done any harm to the rover, so the team kept exploring Gale Crater while keeping in mind their main target, a tall mountain called Mount Sharp, rising 18,000 feet or 5.5 kilometers from the middle of the crater.
Craters sometimes have peaks in them that formed when the crater itself formed. There's usually a little rebound after the meteor hit and created the big crater. But this isn't that. Mount Sharp actually has horizontal layers that you'd see when sediment was brought into that crater and laid down in layers. The mountain is really what drew us to Gale Crater as the landing site for Curiosity, because if you have a mountain made of sedimentary rock, it was either deposited there by wind or water. And when we looked at the layers of the mountain from orbit, we saw two really intriguing ones. One was made of rock that had enrichments in clay minerals, and the one directly above it was made of rocks that had enrichment in sulfate minerals. And the clay minerals, by analogy with Earth, you really would suspect a lot of water was involved in weathering the ancient rocks and turning them into clays. So we had evidence for a wet layer, and maybe that even meant that water brought in all that sediment. And then we had evidence for a drier layer, the sulfate layer, kind of a salty layer. And so that was what made Mount Sharp so interesting, this evidence that water was involved in laying down the sediment and then changing the rocks into various minerals. But the problem was that we couldn't land on the mountain.
Curiosity couldn't touch down right on Mount Sharp because a safe landing required a low, flat area free of hazards like cliffs or big rocks.
So we knew we had to land off in the flat part of the crater floor, away from the mountain. And that meant we were going to have to spend a good year, at least, of the mission just simply driving over to the mountain. Mars rovers drive incredibly slow. On a very good day, we'll drive the length of a football field. And, you know, it takes many, many days and many, many football fields to add up to the distance from the landing site to Mount Sharp. But we could have gotten from our landing site over to Mount Sharp, which is maybe a distance of several miles. We could have gotten there within a few months, but we were really intrigued after we figured out where we landed that there was this area that maybe was an ancient lake not too far away. So we actually landed and drove away from Mount Sharp. We drove in the wrong direction on purpose in order to get to this ancient lake. And it was a risk that we took scientifically. And of course, as a whole mission, we took that risk investing the time to do that, but it really paid off. I think all of us would have said the real home run results of the mission would have come from Mount Sharp, and the crater floor was kind of a crapshoot. And it turned out that we scored a home run right in the first year on the crater floor before we even got to Mount Sharp.
Curiosity revealed that the barren rocks of the crater floor contained echoes of a once rich environment in the ancient Martian past that could have supported life as we know it.
Lo and behold, it was actually one of the best examples of a place that life could have survived, could have prospered even, that we found in the entire mission. And fortunately, it was the very first two drill holes that we drilled. So by interpreting the rocks, we found that plenty of water lasted for a long time. Time is important for life as well. Life can't happen overnight, has to evolve. And then the right chemicals have to be in that environment at the same time the water was there. You have to have carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and phosphorus and sulfur, all these key elements, the building blocks of life, as people say. If they're in the environment at the same time as the water was there, now you're talking. And then the next thing you need, kind of the third part of the puzzle, is a source of energy. And we believe there's sunlight around, of course, in the past, but we also were looking for the kinds of energy that microbes can use when they live underground on Earth, for example. The chemicals and minerals in the rocks sometimes provide that energy for microbes to basically reproduce.
And next week's The Space Show, we will continue the story of Curiosity on Mars. Yes, 10 years on Mars. This has been The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie.